Hello and welcome to The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24. Each week we'll be hearing from the sharpest minds and freshest thinkers in the world of finance, taking you beyond the numbers and the hype and getting to the heart of the big issues of the day. This week we're focusing once again on sustainable investing. Without a doubt, this theme has become increasingly important, but it's typically been confined to rich world assets. Now it's increasingly spreading to emerging markets too. We'll be exploring how it's possible to evaluate the governance, socials and environmental practices in emerging nations. We'll cast a wider eye too over trends in SI, from gender lens investing to green bonds, to a broader overview of why sustainability matters to advisors and investors alike. We'll also pose the question, when will integrating these so-called ESG factors cease to be a niche concern and instead form the foundation to all investment decisions? Sustainable investing is increasingly spreading to emerging markets as well as developed ones. How is it possible then to evaluate the governance, socials and environmental practices in emerging nations? Indeed, are those things trickier in these markets? Simon Smiles is UBS Chief Investment Officer for Ultra High Net Worth.
It's an interesting point, but I also think it's perhaps it's a narrow way manner of viewing sustainable investing. And sustainable investing involves exclusion. Sustainable investing involves integration of ESG factors. Sustainable investing involves impact investing. And if you take each of those in turn, the use of them and the relevance in emerging markets, I'd argue is actually as relevant or more relevant than developed markets, but they do manifest in different ways. Impact investing lends itself very well to emerging markets, not exclusively to emerging markets, but very well to emerging markets, given the huge social needs in many of those areas. The pragmatic integration of environmental, social and governance factors, again, arguably is even more important in emerging market companies, you know, given the relatively more nascent, you know, development of those financial markets. And then when it comes to exclusion, if a person decides based on their own values they don't want to invest in something like tobacco or firearms or otherwise, that will apply whether you're in emerging markets or indeed in developed markets.
Stephen Friedman is based in the UBS CIO in the US and is responsible for thematic and sustainable investment strategy. Stephen co-wrote a recent Gender Diversity Matters research note on the road to parity earlier in the year with Laura Kane. It was also published outside the Americas as Gender Diversity Matters. The key problem he speaks to here, which Simon mentioned, is data availability.
I would say that the principles that you use to invest in a sustainable manner when investing in emerging markets are very much the same as when you're looking at developed economies. Some of the challenges really have to do with the level of data availability. So typically for emerging economies, you don't have the same breadth of data in terms of having the same number of indicators per company. And also, even in cases when you do have data, it may be that you have a much shorter history. So you may have the data today, but typically you would want to have a sense of how that data has evolved over time, and maybe you just have a few years of history, which makes it a little bit more difficult, which doesn't mean that it shouldn't be done. It just means it's a little bit more hard work to be able to apply those approaches. But, you know, it's an area that's growing. There are more and more investors and asset managers that are beginning to offer this type of solution. So investing in emerging markets with a sustainable lens, it's definitely one of the areas where we're seeing this whole thing shift from being emerging, no pun intended, to being a more mainstream way to invest sustainably.
Andrew Lee, Head of Impact Investing and Private Markets in the Chief Investment Office for UBS Wealth Management in the US, adds his view on the challenges around evaluating ESG issues.
Well, historically, you're right. It has been more difficult for investors to get satisfactory solutions that provide exposure to emerging markets that incorporate the E, S, and G considerations into those investments. But increasingly, there are solutions that enable such exposure. So yes, increasingly, it is both available and it is a good opportunity to add value to portfolios. I think it's particularly important. I would actually take it a step further. It's particularly important because there is a wide range of different approaches to ESG within EM equities. And so it creates potential opportunities to screen on these factors for outperformance or just performance relative to global equity indices.
Next, we ask John Amore, Managing Director and Head of Wealth Management Advice at UBS, to discuss impact investing in broad terms. We've seen some notable successes in this space. What's been the most arresting in John's view?
High net worth people have always used their wealth to shape society and influence society, and the growing list of problems the world has is significant, whether it's impacting the people or planet. And the fact that high net worth individuals are now looking to use their investments to drive positive change continues to get momentum every year. And because of that, we continue to see good product innovation and more high net worth families seeking advice on how to use, how to drive their capital towards impact investments.
Jenny Abramson is the founder and managing partner of Rethink Impact, with an extensive track record of leadership roles across the impact tech space, an area upon which she shed some light for us. So what are the big opportunities ahead in impact investing, according to Jenny?
For the longest time, people used to think that impact investing would yield only concessionary returns, so they wouldn't move their main investment dollars to impact. And I think why it's become such a big area is that the data has now proven that impact investing can actually deliver above market rate returns. And that's true whether it's in public debt, like the TIAA CREF Social Choice Bond, outperforming non-social bonds, public equity, like the Dow Jones Sustainable Index, outperforming the S&P 500, or even private equity. Cambridge Associates did a study on venture capital funds and focused on impact investing and saw that they outperformed non-impact peers by about 500 basis points if they were at about $100 million in size. So I think one reason is that there's finally data to show that impact can be at the market. And I think beyond that, now that people know that, that there's this big opportunity, you're seeing that 90% of high net worth individuals are actually saying it's important to spend time driving social impact. And what's interesting is that there's such a gap between that and the support they're getting. Yeah, I think only 11% of clients have talked about impact investing with their advisors. So you're seeing this movement of interest because of data combined with a lack of advice around it that is a big opportunity area.
Jenny Abramson there. Let's get more on gender lens investing now. For more on that theme, let's dive into the report On the Road to Parity. Its co-author Stephen Friedman explains some of the key objectives and findings.
Basically, it all comes down to the question, really viewing an investment approach that focuses on the level of female participation, either at the board level or at the level of senior leadership in companies, and viewing this not as a social factor, right? So if you think of ESG, not viewing it as part of the social pillar, but really viewing it as part of the governance pillar, whereby the view here is that a more diverse leadership, a more diverse board, actually has benefits in terms of the quality of decision making. You have some basis, or pretty strong basis, I would say, in terms of group psychology, which essentially tells you that if you have a more diverse pool of expertise, a more diverse pool of experiences, when dealing with complex situations, groups are going to be better at decision-making when they have that type of diversity. And here, gender diversity is just one element of diversity, but it's probably the easiest one to actually gauge. It's not very difficult to figure out what the ratio of males and females is on the board, whereas other measures of diversity are more difficult to implement. But in a way, with a gender lens investing strategy, focusing on companies that have greater representation of women, you're not only investing with that gender lens, but it may also be a proxy for investing with a diversity strategy more broadly, right? So using that as a way to gauge diversity more generally speaking. And so based on that research at the level of group decision-making processes, there's also quite some literature, and we did some analysis of our own that shows that there is actually a correlation with greater female participation and better financial performance, both at the level of just profitability, but even in terms of financial market performance. It's not a huge difference, but it is something that is noticeable and has been consistent over time. And as a result of these insights, we've recommended a strategy that consists in choosing companies within a broad, diversified equity universe that have that greater share of women at the board and senior management level.
We also asked Jenny Abramson to share some personal insights into gender lens investing in particular. She has a proven track record in this environment. How has her personal history helped her understanding develop? What has shaped her journey?
I think I came at it in two ways. So first, you know, I had been fortunate to go to Harvard Business School and Stanford and had an amazing group of both male and female peers. And when I became a CEO of a tech company, I was surprised to notice how often I might be the only female or one of very few females in a given room or award or whatever the situation was. And I was surprised by this, frankly. And I looked up the data. I realized that less than 3% of venture capital dollars are actually going to women in female-run companies, which is striking in an era like today where education rates are fairly equal. And so part of how I came at this was an interest in moving more capital towards female entrepreneurs or gender-diverse teams, given the opportunity. And the other place was I had run a social impact company, and I saw that having an impact on the world not only didn't hurt your returns, it actually could help your returns. And I saw a lot of other businesses that were ripe for opportunity in the impact space. So it was a combination of these two, sort of a passion for having an impact on the world, something that I had cared about and worked in the private sector, but also in the nonprofit and government sectors, combined with seeing a financial opportunity in both the impact side as well as on the gender lens side that really led me into the venture capital space.
Still to come on the Bulletin with UBS, we'll look at some of the innovative products on offer in this space, and we'll look ahead and ask whether one day soon all investment decisions will be informed by ESG factors. As we've already been hearing, there are many different funds, products and offers in this area, the likes of Green Bonds, the Global Compact Index and others. Among them is the Loans for Growth Fund. We asked Andrew Lee why this in particular is so interesting and what's been at the heart of its development.
One long-standing investment theme for frontier and emerging markets is the need for financing to support the development and creation of new small and medium-sized enterprises in these areas. You have the potential to increase people's access to products and services, broaden the business base, and contribute to development in those local regions. So, you know, earlier this year, we as a firm had concluded fundraising for a strategy to support this general theme where, you know, the business case makes for compelling returns and the social impact is clear and also can be measured.
John Amore, too, speaks to the range of innovative products operating in this space.
And they're doing this across asset classes. There are investors who are looking to do this through public equities. There are investors who are looking through their private investments, through the real estate that they hold, and are looking for innovative things like development impact bonds. And so this is an innovative part of finance that we're seeing where people are using the capital markets to get certain outcomes from their philanthropy. And the UBS Optimus Foundation, which is our foundation focused on the welfare of children in vulnerable places, offered the first development impact bond, which is focused on improving girls' education in India. And the first year results of this development impact bond show that girls in Rajasthan, India are staying in school longer, which is going to have lots of positive consequences down the road for these communities. We got an interest in this not just from investors in India, but globally, and whether they're concerned about education or girls' education, these types of innovative solutions are attracting investor capital from all over the world.
And let's return to the example once more of gender lens investing and ask, what's the scope for further development here? Jenny Abramson takes up the story.
Female-led companies, as I mentioned, only get 3% of venture capital dollars today. And you might ask, is that they perform worse? And in reality, there's now data that shows that when a firm goes from 0 to 30% female leadership, they see a 15% increase in net revenue. And Peterson Institute just came out with that. And similarly, even in the private equity or venture space, companies that have a female on the founding team have performed 63% better financially. And so what's interesting is to sort of look at that data and see what a huge opportunity that is financially, frankly, as much as from an impact standpoint. And I think it's, you know, has in part to do with the fact that investing, especially earlier stage or growth stage investing, is in part something that doesn't have perfect data. And so you're looking as an investor at patterns, and it's a pattern recognition business. And in a world where less than 6% of investment professionals and people in my job or my partner Heidi's job, Patel, are actual decision makers, it's not surprising that you're often drawn to investing in businesses or people in your own image. And so I think there's a real opportunity in this space around not necessarily investing in women only or female CEOs, but in gender diverse teams more broadly. Because if you think about it, there are 70% of consumer spending decisions are being made by women today. So if you don't have women participating in your strategy and your product decision making, you're really leaving money on the table. And I think that's a really interesting opportunity.
And John Amore, for one, agrees that there's space to go much further in this case.
Gender lens investing continues to be a theme that we see is ripe for investment and certainly a lot of interest. That will evolve to not just gender diversity, but any type of diversity. And there's been so much evidence that management teams that incorporate diversity have better evidence of results, better decision making. I can imagine that more investors will see this as a proxy for a well-run firm. And it won't just stop at gender diversity, but look at all diversity. This will also have a lot of positive outputs for society and will lead to more inclusive societies, which will inevitably be good for any type of economic growth.
We've been hearing some enlightened and pretty progressive views on the idea of sustainability in investing. But how long until it's par for the course everywhere? Simon Smiles, for one, certainly believes that a pragmatic integration of ESG factors should be ubiquitous. But is that scenario a long way off in his view?
Look, I hope not. I mean, in terms of my day job and my colleagues' day jobs at UBS, it's something that we're really trying to advance. When it comes again to environmental, social and governance factors and pragmatically integrating them into company valuations, it should be something that is ubiquitous even today. It's simply good fiduciary, it's simply good analysis and directly aligned with an analyst or fund manager's fiduciary duty. Taking into account factors which may affect the future valuation and earnings of a company. When it comes to impact investing, targeting market returns with very impactful, positively impactful investments is by definition just as good a financial decision as a more standard private equity type fund. So if impact investing moves to that rather than sub-market returns, that is something that hopefully in the very near future, you know, will be mainstream, you know, rather than niche.
How far away are we then from a time when sustainable investing and impact investing are no longer niche, but instead of the basis upon which all investments are made? A last word here to Jenny Abramson.
I actually think we're already on this path. Capital that's seeking positive change is really crowding into the market and driving real and lasting impact in terms of both business of wealth management, but also other parts of the future. I mean, if you think about it, from 2012 to 2014, professionally managed assets grew 15%. And you compare that to impact investing assets, they've grown 216% during that same period. And I think that this is becoming mainstream for three reasons. One, a third of baby boomers either own or are interested in owning impact investments. But millennials, 50% of millennials are interested. And millennials are about to receive the largest intergenerational transfer of wealth, $41 trillion over the next few decades. So I think one reason we're moving in this direction and it's becoming mainstream are millennials. I think the second is women are getting a much bigger voice and are taking a greater leadership role in investing. And more than two-thirds of high-net-worth women have actually come into their relationships with as much or more assets than their partners. And I think women are particularly interested in this notion of having a difference in the world while having the returns. And finally, I think because there's so much demand from high-net-worth individuals and foundations and other institutions, you're finding that major banks and institutions are working hard to provide their clients with opportunities in the space. So it's no longer a niche sort of area, but instead moving to the mainstream because there's real institutional capital moving and, frankly, institutional voice that has the ability to accelerate everything else. So I think we're at a really exciting moment for this space, and we're about to see it take off in much larger ways because of these three reasons.
And that's Jenny Abramson bringing us to the end of this 107th edition of The Bulletin with UBS, setting the agenda in the fast-moving world of finance each week here on Monocle 24. Listen again and find out more at monocle.com or catch up via iTunes, SoundCloud or your usual podcast platform. The Bulletin with UBS on Monocle 24.